Welcome to Keeping Up. It's week 20. This is Clay, the I am really sore because I weeded my garden Smith.
This is Jim, and that I'm just sore just thinking about that, Fictal.
So, this is week 20, Keeping Up This Week in Journals. This is a CME offering for Vanderbilt University. On your screen right now should be the disclosure statement. You need to read that. Then you can get your CME credit. Just go to keepingupinem.com and get your credit today. We are going to give you about, well, nine and some swine today. So sit down, hold tight, and here we go.
All right, first up is Kudnick et al., Level 1 versus Level 2 Trauma Centers and Outcomes-Based Assessment, published in this month's Journal of Trauma. So trauma centers have better outcomes than non-trauma centers when it comes to trauma patients. But Level 1 versus Level 2 outcome differences have never been determined. This study was a study of 18,103 patients that were included in this multi-center retrospective review of the Ohio Trauma Registry. Patients were age greater than 15 and must have been transported directly from the scene to a Level 1 or Level 2 center, thus it excluded transfers. Primary outcome was in-hospital mortality, and the secondary outcome was discharge location. 56% of patients were transported to a Level 1 center and tended to have more severe injuries, more pre-hospital interventions, and more in-hospital complications. Now, after adjusting for propensity, which is one of my favorite statistical terms, which is actually a conditional probability of exposure based on many variables, essentially what you need to know, it tries to make the groups equal. Level 1 transports had reduced odds of mortality at an odds ratio of 0.75 and more likely discharged home with an odds ratio of statistically significant 1.14. Now, based on risk stratification, two specific groups, the head injured and the pelvic fractures, had significant reductions in mortality when taken to a Level 1 center. Now, limitations. This is a retrospective study with fancy statistical manipulation of the data, i.e. the propensity score.
Fancy schmancy.
Now, application. What does it mean to us is this study provides some data to adjust pre-hospital transport decisions for traumatic patients, especially those with suspected head injuries and pelvis injuries.
I tend to believe the data because, you know, the mortality was really the same in the Level 1 and the Level 2 centers. And so you're kind of thinking sicker patients go to Level 1 centers. And if the mortality is the same, you know, I tend to believe the data. So they're fancy schmancy statistics, I believe.
No, I believe it. It's just anytime you throw out the propensity scores and the various other tests that the names I don't really recognize, I always get a little concerned. But
oh, I do those on my scientific calculator all the time.
Nice.
Next up is Barrett et al. This is our very own Tyler W. Barrett. Prevalence of incidental findings in trauma patients detected by computed tomography imaging. This was in American Journal of Emergency Medicine in May 2009. Now, incidentalomas are potentially nasty things you don't intend to find when you're obtaining a CT scan for another indication, namely trauma, in this study. The results were over 3,000 patients were included in this retrospective study with excellent methods, Tyler. Authors determined a priori which incidental findings were more serious, they called them type 1, and less serious, they called them type 2. 53% had at least one incidental finding. 990, that's 32%, had a type 1 finding, and 1,274, that's 41.4%, had a type 2 finding. A total of 2,662 type 1 findings and 1,882 type 2 findings were discovered. That's a lot of incidental findings. Findings were more common in women and as age increased. Now, limitations are it was single center, retrospective, and there was heterogeneity in the radiologist's level of detail in reporting incidental findings. Now, all the limitations, however, would lead to underreporting. So it's unknown if patients also were already aware of these incidental findings, and it's unknown what was done to follow them up. The application is this, and this is really coming from Tyler. A conservative estimate is that one-third of the patients you scan will have an incidental finding, and it's our duty to inform the patient. These are easy to let them fall through the cracks.
Exactly. You know, I wanted to rip this paper apart just in honor of Dr. Barrett, but just couldn't do it. But just because a CT is negative for trauma doesn't mean it's negative for disease. And you need to tell the patient about these incidental findings.
And there's some bad stuff that they found.
All right. Next up is Biffel et al. Management of patients with anterior abdominal stab wounds, a Western Trauma Association multi-center trial published in the Journal of Trauma, May 2009. What do we do with anterior abdominal stab wounds that are hemorrhagically stable and asymptomatic? Now, results. Study comprised 359 patients from 11 trauma centers aged greater than 16 with anterior stab wounds with a primary outcome of therapeutic laparotomy. Excluded patients were pregnant, incarcerated, or had penetrating trauma outside the abdominal box. Asymptomatic patients were managed per their own protocols per the center and included fast exams, DPL, CT scans, and local wound exploration. Of the initial 359 patients, 81 went immediately to surgery, and 278 were further evaluated. There was a significant amount of numbers that were discussed as far as sensitivity for fast versus DPL and CT scan. Really, the most important ones were local wound exploration had 100% sensitivity, and serial clinical exams also had 100% sensitivity in this study group, which led to an algorithm that they propose that if someone has penetrating trauma without shock, peritonitis, or evisceration, then perform a local wound exploration. If it's negative, they can go home. If it's positive, then do serial exams. Now, the limitations, there were varied protocols at each center, and there's no true follow-up data to really say that a local wound exploration that was negative had 100% sensitivity.
Yeah.
So you don't really know, out of the people that went home, did someone have a bad outcome? Now, application serial physical exams is not dead. It's still alive and should be utilized. Now, local wound exploration is your friend when performed appropriately and with sterile technique, not just jamming your finger in the hole thinking, oh, it doesn't seem to go in too far.
We see them do that all the time.
It's amazing.
This study makes me nervous. Here's the reason why, because I've had at least 3 bad outcomes where the surgeons did this local wound exploration thing and they were like, well, it doesn't penetrate in. And they ended up with bowel injury. One had serious arterial injury. And so I don't know. This makes me nervous. If they want to explore the wound and then admit the patient and watch them, great. Mm-hmm. I understand that the purpose is to decrease the number of people that are getting admitted, but man, this makes me nervous. So before I embrace this whole hog, I'd say, sure, watch your surgeons do local wound exploration. You better keep that patient around in the ED for a while or they're going to tank.
Sure, everyone deserves a repeat exam, even if local wound exploration is negative. But my feeling is, though, if it's properly done, you can really definitively see the track of the stab wound and can clearly tell it does not go into the anterior fascia. And I feel somewhat comfortable with that.
With all these fried chicken-fed Southerners down here, though, there can be some serious tracts developed.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you have to certainly sedate the patient, expand the wound, really take a good look. It's not just a little, let's put a Q-tip in there and it's fine.
Well, with variability in techniques, it makes me nervous. Mm-hmm. The next article is Miller et al., The Signature Features of Influenza Pandemics, Implications for Policy, New England Journal of Medicine, May 2009. I would also encourage you, we have a hyperlink to the New England Journal H1N1 site that is fantastic. It has an interactive map and a lot of great articles that are all full text and free. So past influenza pandemics can inform current policy and our response in the ED. Past flu pandemics have 5 key features. Number 1, a shift in the virus subtype. Number 2, shifts in the highest death rates to younger populations. 3, successive pandemic waves. 4, higher transmissibility than that of seasonal influenza. And 5, differences in impact in different geographic regions. Now, not only does this inform public policy decision, it must inform us here on the front lines in the ED. Number 1, there is a shift in the virus subtype. You just need to know this is influenza type A, not B, that causes the pandemic flu. Number 2, it's a shift to younger populations. The reason being, older people may have more antibody protection from exposure to past strains that are similar, but not exactly like the pandemic flu that's circulating. So don't be surprised if an influenza pandemic resulted in young people getting sicker. Keep your guard up and don't have a false sense of security that someone's young and healthy and will be safe. Number 3, watch out for ED surges because when it hits, it comes in successive pandemic waves. This is especially important for medical directors to be on their guard and plan for this. Know that there are going to be periods of very high activity in the ED and critically ill patients. Number 4, the pandemic strains have higher transmissibility, usually, than that of the seasonal influenza. So, Use proper infection control measures so you can keep fighting on the front lines there in the ED. Just follow whatever the CDC is recommending when and if this happens. And number 5, know that there are geographic variations in impact of the virus. So just because other parts of the country or the world are having milder cases doesn't mean we can let our guard down. The virus can behave differently in different geographical areas. I think these 5 signature features of influenza pandemics not only inform public policy, but have to inform us here in the ED.
Exactly. This issue of the New England Journal of Medicine actually has several other good articles as well about H1N1, including an article by Daywood that actually describes the initial cases and how the CDC responded. So it's an interesting read on how they're able to adapt their testing. Now, latest update from the CDC website, there's been over 4,300 cases in the United States, 3 fatalities. If you're living in Wyoming, West Virginia, Mississippi, your first case is on the way, because these numbers probably underestimate the true number.
Definitely. So that's the swine flu scorecard at this point. So next up, Sylvanoin, or something like that, clinical presentation of influenza in unselected children treated as outpatients. This is in Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, May 2008. What does influenza look like in kids? You might think that you know, but it really hadn't been studied, so hence this article. This was a prospective study of outpatients less than 13 years of age. There were 2,231 child seasons of follow-up data that were obtained. Any illness that the parents brought the kid in for resulted in a flu swab being collected. If they stubbed their toe, flu swab. 353 patients were included. Now, 95% of them had fever. Interestingly, they defined fever as greater than 37.5 degrees Celsius, or 99.5. I don't really call it a fever, but 90% had fever defined as temp greater than 38 degrees, or 100.4. Over half had very high fever, greater than 39 degrees Celsius, that's 102.2. Next, 70% had cough, 78% had rhinitis, and in kids age 7 to 13 years, that could describe if they had myalgias or headaches. Surprisingly, only 39% had headache and 14% had myalgia. In addition, GI symptoms were rare, occurring in only 9% of children. Influenza A accounted for 88% of the cases, B for 12%, with no difference in symptoms between the two. Now, the limitations, this was a study in Finnish kids. They were all outpatients. And selection bias could have resulted in underreporting. Recall bias could also affect accurate reporting. The parents might not remember how many days their symptoms had lasted, that sort of thing. And it's important to know that Wyeth and GlaxoSmithKline provided part of the study support. The application is this. Influenza in kids is usually associated with fever, often high fever. GI symptoms are rare, as are headache and myalgia in kids. Now, important note, this may be different with pandemic flu strains versus seasonal flu. This was standard run-of-the-mill seasonal flu. So be aware, you may have more GI symptoms with this new H1N1, that sort of thing. So watch the CDC website for the clinical manifestations.
Yeah, I think in Denmark, though, they had more headaches and myalgias than their kids, but that's just me.
These Finland children.
That's right.
Finland flu.
I love the Finnish kids. All right, next up is Fernandez Valencia et al., the Spaso Technique, a prospective study with 34 dislocations. How effective is a Spaso Technique for reducing anterior shoulder dislocations? And you're probably wondering, what the hell is the Spaso Technique? Another name, shoulder reduction technique.
Spaso. Well, it's like shoulder spasm.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the Spaso Technique, which we'll have a picture of, has the patient lying supine, the arm is forward flexed to 90 degrees, vertical traction is applied, the arm is slightly externally rotated. The success rate in this study was 67%, which was less than the other two series that showed success rates of 87 and 91%. So the limitations of this study is that there were no uniform sedation or regional anesthesia protocols for these patients, which does have some effect on the outcome.
I should say.
For this. Now, the application is, I like this technique. It's kind of my second maneuver if slow external rotation fails. I combine this with a little bit of scapular manipulation, so pushing the scapular tip medially, and I always use intra-articular lidocaine for these patients. And I very rarely sedate people anymore for shoulders. Even for difficult ones, you can apply a significant amount of traction by lowering the patient's bed and, as always, lifting with the legs.
That's right. It's got to be OSHA approved when you do the spazo technique. I prefer the Mel Gibson technique. You know, slam your shoulder into the door frame. That's 100% effective.
You know, the last time I was in a straitjacket, it was pretty effective for me to get out of there, but nice.
So next up, Hartfield et al. The association between iron deficiency and febrile seizures in childhood. This was in Clinical Pediatrics, May 2009. Many are moving away from the AAP recommendations to strongly consider LP in all febrile seizures in kids less than 12 months, especially now that we have Hib and pneumococcal vaccine. See a recent Keeping Up discussion on this subject. We've got it hyperlinked in the written summary. We do very little diagnostic workup on these kids these days, but here's something worth considering. Iron deficiency. Four prior case control studies have shown some conflicting results, so this study sought to be larger and somewhat of an arbiter between these. The results: this was a well-designed, well-matched case control study with a priori definition of iron deficiency as an MCV less than 70 and an RDW greater than 15.6. They had 361 cases, 390 controls. 9% of cases had iron deficiency versus only 5% of controls. There was no statistically significant difference in iron deficiency with anemia. That is, you could have iron deficiency and not yet have dropped your hemoglobin. The odds ratio using logistic regression was 1.84. Now, the limitations are inherent and are always present with retrospective case control design. The study was underpowered, assuming a 9% prevalence of iron deficiency, but actually the prevalence in the controls was only 5%, and the results did end up statistically significant. The application is, if you're going to be drawing labs in a febrile seizure patient for another reason, just consider adding a CBC to look at the MCV and RDW for iron deficiency. It is almost twice as common in febrile seizure patients than the general febrile population.
I think the only one of the concerns about this, though, is that there's other reasons why you can have a low MCV and a high RDW in patients other than just straight iron deficiency. And so I wonder if those other factors would also put you at risk, you know, such as lead poisoning or thalassemias and maybe underlying chronic disease that just haven't been diagnosed yet.
That's a great point. They commented on the lead poisoning bit on the article and said that their prevalence of lead poisoning in their population was very low, around the order of 1%. So they didn't think it would be a huge confounder, but that's a great point.
Mm. All right, next up is Lim et al. Slow infusion of calcium channel blockers compared with intravenous adenosine in the emergency treatment of supraventricular tachycardia, published in Resuscitation, May 2009. Study question regarding this is, first, it was verapamil for SVT, and then it was adenosine for SVT. However, there's not really been a large study in a patient care setting comparing slow infusion calcium channel blockers and adenosine. Now, results of this study was a prospective randomized clinical trial that enrolled patients greater than 10 years old presenting to the ED with SVT. Exclusion criteria were conversion with vagal maneuvers, which never happens to me, altered mental status, pulmonary edema, pregnant, and those with a final diagnosis other than SVT. Now, of the 233 patients that were randomized, and then excluding those who had other diagnosis, final diagnosis, they ended up having 48 patients in the verapamil group, which received infusion of 1 milligram per minute, up to 20 milligrams. 54 went to diltiazem group, which was 2.5 milligrams per minute, up to 50 milligrams. And then 104 went to the adenosine arm, which were given 6 milligrams first and then 12 milligrams if that failed. Non-converters would then cross over based on a second randomization and then, if needed, shocked. So the conversion rates were significantly higher for calcium channel blockers. 98% of their patients,
that's not bad,
converted with a slow infusion rate compared to adenosine. Now, the mean dosages were 6.5 milligrams for verapamil and almost 17 milligrams for diltiazem, with 88% of the diltiazem required less than 25 milligrams to convert. So the limitations, this study really underdosed adenosine.
Yeah.
I think other subsequent studies have shown that 12 milligrams is better to start unless you're going through a central line. Application to our practice is, you should consider slow infusion of calcium channel blockers with SVT, especially for the pulmonary patients, even though they gave them adenosine, didn't have any ill effects to patients with history of asthma or COPD. But I'm still a little bit concerned. If you've seen adenosine clamp someone down, before. Yeah. It's always in the back of your mind when you go to give it.
Yeah.
So consider the slow infusion of calcium channel blockers.
Yeah, we actually had to intubate a guy at the VA that we gave adenosine to. He locked down and couldn't breathe.
My first ever intubation in the emergency department as a resident was someone that we gave adenosine to, and they just locked down.
And the patients just feel like, do. When they get that adenosine,
oh, yeah.
They're like, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I'm not.
Yeah. So I think I will start at least considering, other than the straightforward run-of-the-mill SVT, a healthy patient, using a slow infusion diltiazem, which is what we commonly use here,
absolutely,
at 2.5 milligrams per minute.
It did drop their pressure a little bit, but not that much. It was like, what, 10 or 13?
Yeah, not very much at all. And only one patient actually had to be stopped, essentially, from the verapamil infusion and ended up getting cardioverted.
Next up is Rabani et al. Green banana reduces clinical severity of childhood shigellosis. A double-blind, randomized, controlled clinical trial in Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, May 2009. Now, you might be saying to yourself, what the heck are you doing green banana and shigellosis? Here's the deal. Are you saying that, Jim?
I say, why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, I picked this article because it is just awesome, and there are no safe anti-diarrheal medications for kids. They had kaopectate, which used to contain atipulgite, binding, adsorbing toxins, whatever the heck. Now they don't even make it in the U.S. anymore. The kaopectate now is bismuth subsalicylate, which you don't give kids because the salicylate. So it's very frustrating when you have kids that are pooping their brains out and you just have to tell the mom, sorry, nothing I can do. Why don't you avoid giving them pear juice, which has a lot of non-absorbable sugars? So this is cool. Green banana is known to contain amylase-resistant starch and increase colonic production of short-chain fatty acids, which colonocytes love, by the way, and this improves diarrheal disease. The authors have already done some studies in other diarrheal illnesses, and they wanted to see if they could treat kids with severe Shigella dysentery. The results, this was a randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial with all kids getting oral rehydration or IV fluids as needed, ciprofloxacin orally, and a nutritional rice-based paste that was standardized 54 kilocalories per liter. There were 35 in the with green banana mushed into this paste and 39 without the green banana mush added. Now you might say, how can this be double-blinded when one has banana and one doesn't have banana? That's a great question. What they did is they flavored and colored it to taste and smell the same. That's very cool. It was strawberry flavored, by the way. This was fed to the children ad lib by the parents, and these kids were aged 6 to 60 months. Outcomes at day 5 were significantly better, both clinically and statistically, in the green banana group. Decreased mucus in blood, decreased stool frequency and volume, and increased clinical cure rate, 85% versus 67%, and this was highly statistically significant, and I would say clinically significant as well. The limitations, this was done in patients with dysentery in Bangladesh, and only boys were studied, and this was to facilitate ease of separating pee and poop. You know, put a little bag on there, and you've collected your urine.
Mm-hmm.
And it potentially affects the generalizability. Application to your practice. I think we've found a safe, cheap, highly effective anti-diarrheal medication for kids in the produce aisle of your grocery store. Green banana.
This is awesome. So they take rice, they mix in banana, and make it taste like strawberries.
The miracles of modern medicine.
This is amazing. And it's effective.
It works. Yeah. I mean, if we had a randomized controlled trial of some cardiac drug that was this effective, it would be plastered all over the headlines.
And have a much catchier title.
Yeah, it would be like, green banana rocks your world.
Chiquita Shigella coming to save you. I like it.
I like it too. That's This Week in Journals. I hope you've enjoyed it. And please tell your friends and come back and listen again. Go to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and you can get your CME credit for this. And again, you need to see the CME disclosure statement that's at the beginning. It's also on our website. And you can also find other fun stuff there, old articles, the blog, and lots of great stuff. And a written summary that has all of these things written out. And it's got hyperlinks directly to Medline so that you can go to the article and read it for yourself.
All right. Everyone have a good week out there. Keep on keeping up.
That's right. That's still cheesy.
Every time.
I'm going to go take some naproxen.